Blog Talk Radio.
Good Saturday to you. Hi, this is Cliff. Boy, if you're up here where I am in Northern California, we've just been hit by a number of storms, and not going to say too much negatively about it, but roads blocked, hills falling, people swimming in streets, roadways, unnavigation, you can't navigate them. But, you know, we don't like having water issues in Northern California, and we have had problems for the last 3 years. So personally, I welcome the rain, and if you're in anywhere around California, you know that it's been very plentiful and a little overwhelming. So wherever you're listening, I hope you're having a great day and the weather's not distracting you too much, but it's been distracting us, but it's a good thing. It is a good thing. So much going on in the last week or so. I always refer to the Facebook page and what's happening globally. Earth Ancients Facebook page, if you click on it. Constant discoveries in the Middle East. It's funny because you don't read about the archaeological teams that are digging in the Giza Plateau or anywhere around dynastic Egyptian relics, but they a team at the Luxor Temple at Karnak has discovered a number of small grave sites with figurines that they've actually not seen before. And it's a French-Egyptian team found a number of small statues of Osiris, the Egyptian god, and they identified them as the goddess of the underworld and the dead. The title of this post is Statuettes Discovered at Luxor's Karnak Temple Complex, and they're quite old, a couple thousand years old, but what's unique about them is they have gold tint on them, and they haven't found anything with gold on these on statues previous in that area. So take a look. I've posted a couple of the statues. Actually, there's one central figure, and then if you click on the link, there's a couple of more. But what's kind of unique about the Giza Plateau is that they find these shallow graves, and they find statuettes, and they find artifacts that are significantly older than the actual remains of the person who are in there, sometimes as many as 1,000 years older than the person who's there. And it's kind of startling as to how that can be. It's like what you might say out-of-date artifacts in these remains. But it's questions that keep coming up. It makes you wonder if they cherished their ancestors into the thousands of years and kept their relics around that long. So We know the Maya, and we know that a lot of other ancient civilizations did build on top of previous generations. And so it would make sense. It's just not something that we consider today. Of course, we keep things from our relatives that go into a few hundred years, but these are relics that go into thousands of years. So it's kind of an interesting something to think about. I also want to give you something also to think about. The Bronze Age grave site that was found in Denmark, which kind of relates to Egypt. And inside this one grave, they found Egyptian beads. And they found 23 glass beads that are, and they actually analyzed them with plasma spectrometry, and which is a way to scan hard rock and metals and glass. And the beads come from Egypt. And this was a grave site in Denmark that is dated to the about 3,000 years old, which is, it's the it's pretty old. And to find Egyptian beads in this grave is startling. And how they got there, who knows? No way to know. Title of that article is "Bronze Age Grave in Denmark Contains Egyptian Beads," and that's in Archaeology Magazine, which has been out now for about 3 weeks. So take a look at that. As always, I'm posting information on ancient giants. Patrick Chouinard is going to be my guest in about 3 weeks. And his book on The Lost Race of the Giants has kind of been a benchmark. Him and his work, and also Richard Dewhurst, who I had on the program earlier in the year, are really turning over the rocks and digging into this subject with great force and opening a lot of eyes. Now, there was a report earlier this week that the Smithsonian Institute had been identified as the source of hiding and destroying remains and artifacts of giants who were in North America. If you don't, if you sh that article turned out to be false. It was posted by World Daily News, and that is a satire. And it's unfortunate that even people like Graham Hancock have been posting that without really looking into it. And I think actually, I heard from someone the other day that he finally pulled it from his website. And I've been fooled by World Daily a couple of times with their posts. And so I'm very careful not to post anything from them. It's a satire. And they write in such a convincing tone and with such seeming solid evidence that it fools people. And a number of associates have posted that article about the Smithsonian, and just beware of what you're reading, because the internet can post anything without validation, without references, without authority. Anyone can post anything. That's the biggest issue with the internet, is that tons of information, but a lot of it may not be quite valid. So beware of that. But anyhow, getting back to this article, Giants, Mythology and Remembrance, as Remembrance was posted a couple of days ago. It's a great article by Chouinard, and I really suggest that you take a look at it and read the article, because it covers not only mythology, but it covers actual evidence of human beings that are anything from 18 feet to 30 feet in height, and that's a big person. That's quite a large person. So take a look at that. I always suggest that you take a look at the Facebook page, Earth Ancients Facebook. I continually post almost on a daily basis, as well as the number of associates who are posting information. And the station, Earth Ancients startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past was directly associated and was created because of the Facebook page and because you wanted more information. I'm happy to announce that Blog Talk Radio has now given Earth Ancients Radio the distinction of a featured broadcast. We're like one of the top alternative stations and have, as of last week, are now a featured presentation with thousands of people listening, and I really do appreciate that, so please do keep listening. this is a free program. I love it, and this is a personal interest of mine, but you are the listener, and I do you know, hear what you're interested in and what you'd like to hear about every week. So thank you for listening to the program. My guest today has been studying North American culture, ancient culture, for over 25 years. I actually posted some of his material earlier in the week from his book. I'm going to bring him on here in a second. Before I do, we have had other presenters talk about ancient America, but I think that a lot of times they're taking, like, as an example, Richard Dewhurst took examples from articles that were posted in the 1800s. And his book on the giants in ancient America was more of a reference guide than an actual research guide. Carl Lehrberger, who is my guest today, and by the way, his book is Secrets of Ancient America, Archaeoastronomy and the Legacy of the Phoenicians, Celts, and Other Forgotten Explorers, is the work of a true investigator. Now, Carl has studied archaeological and sacred sites in North America with a focus on ancient Old World people for more than 25 years, as I mentioned, and he's published articles in Ancient American Magazine, and he's an avid traveler and explorer. But, you know, I've spoken to Carl a couple of times, and he, 25 years in the field is quite an accomplishment right there. But what's fascinating is he chronicles his work, but not only his work, the work of a number of other explorers and another researchers who have been around for decades. So, Carl, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Chris, and thanks, Cliff, and thanks for having me on your show.
It's great to have you. You know, 25 years of study is amazing. You know, after 25 years, what was the desire to take the time to write a book on your research? And it's not a small book. It's actually over 400 pages, which is quite a tome, I would say. But what was the motivation to bring it all together?
Well, let me begin by offering greetings to your Earth Ancients Radio listeners. As to my interest, I have been working at this for several decades. However, not as a full-time or a professional. I'm a renewable energy advocate and entrepreneur, and that's really the focus of my professional career. However, in 1986, I read a book by Barry Fell called America BC. It was a startling book that did capture the imagination of many people. It was relatively a popular book until a tremendous amount of controversy came up about what he wrote. And Dr. Fell, who was a microbiologist at Harvard, began to look at diffusionism and ancient travelers around the world. Diffusionism refers to a school of thought that culture emanates from the outside, as opposed to the prevailing school of thought today of the isolationist, that
right.
Believes that culture is internal. So Barry Bell's book describes literally hundreds of examples of old world contacts in the Americas, including artifacts, stone inscriptions, stories, but mostly Dr. Fell was an epigrapher and looked at ancient mm-hmm. writing. It made a very convincing case for me and got me really excited about it, because much of what he wrote about were the travels of Celts from the Iberian Peninsula. And I was in mm-hmm. New England at the time, and much of the evidence presented by Dr. Fell originated in New England. So after reading the book, I set about to really discover the new history of America as somewhat introduced by Dr. Fell. And I would go on to say that I wasn't alone. Many writers and researchers in the 70s and 80s and 90s really began their research with looking at Dr. Fell's material. And while many diffusionists don't agree with all of his conclusions, and most of traditional archaeology historians and anthropologists don't agree with any of it, it was a great starting point to get into the discovering a new history.
Okay. Well, let's get right into it. We have about an hour today. I want to get into the first chapter, which is Christopher Columbus, and you actually have a new spin on him that I haven't heard about. He was not only a unique individual, but he had quite a few maps that we don't know about. Why don't you tell us about that, chapter one, which is on Christopher?
Well, I begin the book by talking about Christopher Columbus, and conclude the chapter by stating that what has come down to us about Columbus discovering America is a total mythology. And a part of the storyline that has come down that Columbus, you know, discovered America, as I present in the book, is really intended to disguise not only what happened, but the consequences of his so-called discovery. And, you know, moderns are sometimes under the opinion that Columbus, you know, was sailing to China and was going to present, you know, gifts to Genghis Khan. But what we now know is that Columbus had access to many different maps were maps of the world, maps of the round world, and these maps, mm-hmm. Most of them originated from Arab libraries that were taken over by the Christians in Spain, and complete Arab libraries that contained literature, astronomy, science, mathematics, really spurned the age of enlightenment in Europe. This new knowledge that was now available after the Dark Ages. But interestingly enough, what hasn't got out of those records were the maps, and there were thousands of them from mm-hmm. Arab explorers. And this is what Columbus and his brother Bartholomew had access to. It's also curious that Columbus's wife was also of the bloodline of Henry Sinclair, who was a Norwegian explorer, and no doubt Columbus had access, if not to the oral histories of those expeditions, but perhaps maps. So the position in the book that I've taken is Columbus knew exactly where he was going. He knew from the maps, he knew how to get there, and from the records left by the Arabs, he knew how long it would take, and he had just enough provisions to make it to the Americas. So clearly, what has come down to us is history is really more mythology.
Right. And would you say that, of course, it's a myth that Columbus was the first one to land in the Americas. We now know that there is other evidence of other cultures having been in America. But would you say that at the time of his sailing to America, that the maps that he had in his care showed that there were earlier civilizations that had already been to America? Is that correct?
I can't. I really can't speculate about that because, I don't have. One record says that he had 10,000 maps when he died. I don't know the history and even the entries of his journal that are now considered to be his. In reviewing those journals, I came to the conclusion that they were really doctored up by the church to really disguise his mission and to disguise his knowledge of the Americas. But clearly, by the time he arrived in the Americas, and he did not make it to the American continent, North American continent, there was evidence of recent travelers to America that later explorers could see. And a great example of that is the Newport Tower in Rhode Island. And this is a unique structure that has been on the American continent ever since the Columbus era. And so that when the later explorers came to explore New England, this tower, the Newport Tower, which was a round tower made of stone, and it has all sorts of archaeoastronomy and unique features, very analogous to some of the Knight Templar structures. Well, this was found in America when the first English explorers made it to New England, and there it was. So this is kind of some of the most latest actual evidence that the old world peoples had made it to America. This would have been in the 1100 or 1200s, but clearly other evidence goes back thousands of years that Columbus was last, not first.
Interesting. The part of your book that I find fascinating is the real true archaeoastronomy evidence that you show in the Southwest and a number of sites. In one of your chapters, I think it's called, let's see, Chapter 6, Sacred Sexuality and the Pathfinder Site, you describe the importance of this site. Can you tell us a little bit of why the Pathfinder Site is so unique for America, the North America area, and just the strength of that discovery? Because I think it's fairly significant.
Well, you mentioned the importance of archaeoastronomy in the book, and to our audience, just to go back a couple of steps, I used archaeoastronomy as a significant tool in researching the ancients because archaeoastronomy, which is a combination of astronomy and archaeology, and looks at the sun and astronomical phenomena in archaeological sites, is a fundamental language of the ancients. And we're all familiar with Stonehenge and, to a lesser extent, Newgrange in Ireland, and to some extent, Chaco Canyon archaeoastronomy sites. But throughout North America, natives and old world peoples left their mark in stone and tracked the cycles of the sun and, to a lesser extent, the moon by developing rock art that reflected the calendrics of the people. So this has been kind of a missing ingredient in looking at the archaeology of North America. And as an important beginning point for me in Pathfinder site in Colorado by my mentor, William McGlone, who, along mm-hmm. with Philip Leonard and other scholars, penned ancient American inscriptions, plow marks for history. And mm-hmm. when I met Bill and was really eager to learn about the old world people, he was a little skeptical of me at the beginning because of the difficulty of getting acceptance him seeking to have alliances with credible researchers. And he introduced me first to the Pathfinder site, which is not a old world site whatsoever. It's a pre-Anasazi, early Native American archaeoastronomy site. And it contained elaborate, what I came to call Heliolithic animations, which are moving picture shows using the light and the shadow on a rock art panel, so that the light and shadow will move across and conjunct with or intersect with the petroglyphs. Now, an archaeoastronomy site is crafted to have specific and intentional alignments on specific days, so that as those light and shadows move across a rock art panel, they're going to move from one day to the next depending upon the position of the sun. But as Bill McGlone wrote and taught me, the key to any archaeoastronomy site or historical site is the intentionality of the creators, so that to have a light dagger or a light beam specifically strike a circle in a very intentional way is evidence that it was intended by the creators who did that. So the Pathfinder site, which was pristine when I was introduced to it and hasn't had a lot of research, you know, allowed me to do some exploring and studying, and year after year going back, I made some very important insights in terms of how the ancients, in this case, the ancestors to Native Americans, thought, and in terms of their symbols and in their cosmologies, they're presented in the rock art and the archaeoastronomy. And in the case of the Pathfinder site, we were able to really see a ancient myth of the Native Americans take place, the story of First Mother or Changing Woman. So it was very exciting over a period of about a decade to be at the site, make those discoveries, work with other researchers to come up with a theory of an interpretation. And it was a profound beginning to my research into ancients in America.
Now, is there some connection that you and your fellow researchers found with Pathfinder that connects with, say, the Celts or the Egyptians or any other ancient civilization? Was there any references to an earlier connection that the Anasazi had?
No, I would say there was not any direct connections. And, you know, as a researcher, we have our own theories about origins and the conveyance of information. As an example, within a radius of, perhaps 50 miles, there are a half a dozen old world sites that have old world writing and old world inscriptions. So, you know, one could theorize that there was a connection there. But I want to take this opportunity to point out that of the tens of thousands of petroglyph sites in North America, only a handful, only really a couple of dozen at most that I found, provide evidence or proof that the old world travelers from either Trans-Pacific or Trans-Atlantic cultures made it to America. So it's not like they're everywhere and let's go out and find them. There are very few of them. But in the case of the Pathfinder, we're just going to have to leave that discussion in terms of a connection to the old world for another time, because there was just not a direct connection that can be made. However, I would say that the mythology that is presented in the story of Changing Woman, where father, son, impregnates first mother, is and this is portrayed in the Paleolithic animation, is a myth that we see around the world, including the story of Zeus and other mythological characters. But to answer your question, there is no direct connection, and I just used it, the story of the Pathfinder, as an opportunity to introduce field work and to introduce archaeoastronomy in the book.
Okay, more of an education to the reader as to what archaeoastronomy is in the Americas, is what you're saying.
To the language of archaeoastronomy, because when we talk about sacred sexuality, it's something that there might be a little aversion to, but this is the language the ancients spoke.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. I want to let our listeners know that this is Carl's first interview. He's been researching and completing and editing the final version of the book, Secrets of Ancient America. And I have been very happy to get Carl. Carl is now in his promotional phase, and we are the first, Earth Ancients is the first radio program that he is speaking to us about. So we're going to get, I hope, some real fresh material, Carl. But hey, I want to congratulate you on completing your book and actually moving into the promotional phase of the work. I want to ask you about a chapter that you have called More Celtic America. You actually show evidence of a presence in North America, but I also would like to hear what you discovered from a Padre Carlo Crespi's collection, who is in South America, and you actually show some amazing photographs of some of the pieces that were given to him, I guess, by the local natives who found them in caves and rock and in artifacts and things like that. Can you tell us a little bit about that connection, the Celtic connection?
Yeah, and let me just begin by talking a little about Father Carlo Crespi, since you introduced him. And it is the story of Crespi and the Crespi collection is somewhat indicative of the archaeological record that has the potential of documenting old world travelers in America. Crespi traveled, I think, from Italy to Ecuador in the 20s, and over time amassed a huge collection of art. Much of it was modern, but a lot of the pieces from the collection came from indigenous peoples that came and either sold them or gave them to Father Crespi. And among the collection are gold plates with Babylonian or Assyrian images very clearly crafted, so that they're really unmistakable. Because of the overarching archaeological paradigm, these artifacts really haven't been given much credibility, and the collection after his death was sold, and some of it's even really gone forever. Some of it's in private collections. Even to this day, there hasn't been a thorough examination of the remaining artifacts. So this particular aspect of the story really is talking more about Phoenicians and Phoenician travelers, and is one of many examples of artifacts and inscriptions from Phoenicians. However, mm-hmm. the artifacts, while can be faked, and many of them have been in my research, rock art is not so easy to fake. It's possible, but because of the patina or the the material that builds up in the rock art, it can be dated. It's much harder to fake, and in some cases, I'd argue impossible to fake the rock art inscriptions that we find throughout the Americas. And in the case of mm-hmm. the Celts had a very evolved language and writing system. And where they traveled, they inscribed stones with their petroglyphs, with their writing system, which is called Ogham, sometimes spelled O-G-A-M, sometimes spelled O-G-H-I-M, H-A-M. And it's a writing system made up of lines. And mm-hmm. the system can be read in different Celtic languages, including, in some instances, Gaelic, including, in some instances, Old Irish. However, I refer to most of the inscriptions as being written in Gaelic. And beginning in New mm-hmm. England, in some of the stone chamber sites in Vermont and in New Hampshire, and continuing on to Colorado, Kansas, Oklahoma, and in later periods into Kentucky, the Celt explorers left their mark in stone, a carved writing, and in many cases the inscriptions are accompanied by very sophisticated archaeoastronomy. So, an mm-hmm. example of one particular site, which I would call proof that the Celts were here, is a cave in Colorado. It's located on Comanche National Grasslands, and inside the cave is a inscription in Ogham that interpreted in Celtic reads, "The sun strikes here." And on the equinox, the sun comes into this cave, this very thin opening cave, and precisely on the day of the equinox, the sun shines exactly where it's indicated in the inscription. And leading mm-hmm. up to the equinox, they have tick marks. So, you can actually sit there and count the days leading up to the equinox. So when you have the corroboration of a inscription that was written and referring to an event, and then you have the archaeoastronomy event, that becomes pretty close to 100% proof. Now, I say 100% because the inscription really isn't that big, but in other nearby sites, there are much more elaborate descriptions invoking the sun god Bel, and urging worshipers that it's time to worship on the day of Bel. And these mm-hmm. Inscriptions are accompanied by really not just calendrical alignments where a beam will strike the middle of a circle, which is, a calendrical alignment, but a heliolithic mm-hmm. animation where a story is being told as these light and shadows move across the panel. And an example yeah. of one of the stories is the death of the sun god on equinox sunset. And it's very clearly shown as the sun god goes into shadow, and an image of a canine figure with a staff coming out of its back, clearly an image of an Anubis from Egypt, mm-hmm. a canine. As the sun god goes into shadow, the Anubis character lightened as the sun goes down. And this is telling the reader that with the death of the sun god, with the coming of the days getting shorter, the god of night, Anubis, is now ruling. And this is played out again with the inscription. So throughout America, we do find a limited number of these Celtic inscriptions, most often mm-hmm. accompanied by archaeoastronomy, and most often found on the equinoxes, but to some lesser extent also found on solstices and the cross quarter days, which were very important Celtic holidays. The four cross quarter days are the equal points between equinoxes and the solstices. So an example would be May Day or Beltane.
Okay. So what is the prevailing wisdom of these Celtic ruins in terms of dating? Is there any way that we can date or estimate when they were put on there? Are we talking about Ice Age periods, 10,000 years or older? Or what do we have in terms of an understanding for when these people were traveling in North America and stopped and needed to know details about the sun and perhaps alignments for good crops and things like that?
Well, that's a great question, and I wish there was a straightforward answer I could give you. But I'll use the opportunity to suggest that this is one of a rich area for modern archaeologists, anthropologists, epigraphers, and archaeoastronomers to get involved in, because there's just been so much negativity regarding diffusionism. Most academics really shy away from it. So here's a very specific area of petroglyphic dating that could be tremendously advanced with the participation of a new generation of archaeologists. However, to address your question, the short answer is they're about, at least in the Colorado Oklahoma sites that I studied, they're going to be approximately 2,000 years old, probably originating between 200 BC and 300 AD. We can estimate this based on the experimental dating called Kapton dating that has been undertaken. We can also estimate this by the actual constellations in the sky that are quartered in these rock art panels. Quite often an event like a triple conjunction might have been recorded, and so we can potentially back into the dating looking at the petroglyphic images. And also some of the petroglyphic images, this a particular site in Oklahoma, which appears to be a temple dedicated to Mithras, the old world god of the Celts, and before then Mitra, from the Indus Valley area. And at this particular site, we are able to ascertain some dating because of the way the petroglyphs were drawn, specifically relating to the bull and the sacrifice of the bull in later-day Celtic Mithraism, as opposed to what we see in the Anubis Caves in Oklahoma, where we don't see the sacrifice. So the best guesstimates we have are, at least in the New England area, at least 2,000 years ago, and in Colorado, probably in that range a little later. And in some cases, we see old Irish ogham showing up in Kentucky, and that would be much later. That would be probably around the 10th or the 11th century. So what we're seeing is a continuity of different Celtic explorers from different eras, and also probably using different languages as well.
But don't we find examples of dynastic Egyptian petroglyphs and other remains in southeastern United States, like Colorado? I mean, you touch on that a little bit. It's so curious if these people were here in North America 2,000 years ago. I mean, what was the reason for them to travel that far? I mean, was it a normal route? Did they come here and harvest? I mean, what's your hypothesis on these people coming out this far with a home base thousands of miles away?
Well, there's a lot there, Cliff, but let me try to touch upon some of your points. There is evidence of the Egyptians, but it's just not as clear. It's just not like the smoking gun. And as a researcher, when you go back and you look at the research, it, just like you kind of alluded to in your introduction regarding, you know, the story of giants and misinformation that comes out, there's so much misinformation in this area, and there's so much controversy that, first of all, finding what's authentic and intentional and what's a possible maybe artifact and what's fake, really takes some expertise. And in some cases, I couldn't make that call, not being an expert in pictography or in, mention, of course, the Egyptian presence and influence, and cite some cases. I really rested my case for old world travelers in America on the Celts, because in the case of the Celts, not just at one site, but at numerous sites, we have their inscriptions in stone, we have their petroglyphs, and in the case of the Celts, we will find Celtic goddesses in inscribed in stone, including Shelah na Gig and an Epona goddess. So that's where the case is to be made, and it's not to say that there aren't a lot of examples cited in the literature, but in terms of presenting a new history, one has to be so careful and not only documenting and referencing, but not citing, things that are questionable or fakes. So that's why more was spent on the Celts. Now, as to what were they doing here and why did they come and had to get here? Well, one has to appreciate that the ancients were very different than the modern view of the ancients. So a great example would be, well, how did they get here? How could they possibly have gotten here? Comes up, day in this topic. And the answer is so obvious. That is, they sailed in large ships. Now, it's obvious when you look at the history of seafaring nations like the Celts and like numerous Indus Valley civilizations from India and even the Chinese. They had large sailing vessels many times bigger than what Columbus had. They could take hundreds of men, and there's even images that you find in Indonesia of showing these large boats, and they're loading elephants onto them, to carry them, in these large voyages. So, we have to understand that as moderns, we've been presented with a distorted view of the ancients. They had not only the capabilities of sailing here and doing advanced navigation, but they were miners and alchemists, great navigators, and they had a wisdom that we're now just beginning to appreciate. What, in my opinion, drove the migrations both across the Pacific and across the Atlantic, principally the search for metals, gold and silver among them. And probably the most famous of these mining operations occurred in Michigan, where the richest deposits of copper can still still be found, where you have almost 99% pure copper near the surface. So for literally thousands of years, the Bronze Age, to a large extent, came about because of this great copper deposits that were mined in Michigan and brought back to Europe, Mediterranean, by the Phoenicians mostly, but other cultures as well. So what drove these explorations, to what was referred to as the underworld? America is the underworld. If you look at the globe and look at India or look at Asia, we're the underworld. So coming to the underworld for the riches, the gold, the silver, but also to explore, and in the case of the Celts, to colonize, were the motivations.
That's interesting. Now, I have to ask you, because you already brought this up a little bit about revealing information. Your title of your book, Secrets of Ancient America, Secrets. Is there a hint there that we have not been told the truth about America? Is there an academic, I don't want to say conspiracy, but is there evidence that we have purposely but not given the information about early America?
Well, the point of the book is the answer is yes. And I think that I provide a kind of a background to how this came about and the rationale behind it. But clearly, many records, many ancient petroglyphic sites that do provide evidence of old world travelers are either completely ignored or not provided any kind of credibility by the archaeological community. If I could just read a paragraph from the book, I think it sums it up pretty nicely. A lesson to be learned from the old history of America is that we have been lied to. The record was expunged and an ethnic and religious agenda was promoted. But is it solely the historians and archaeologists who have deviated from the truth? Do other foundations of modern thought require reexamination, reconstruction, and rebirthing? Are we moderns willing to challenge the old thinking, including the many distortions of the old history? Our state of oblivion is as profound now as it has ever been. In short, the situation is just as I observed in the case of the Columbus mythology, where I came across a plethora of examples of altered or fraudulent material that has found its way into our national consciousness. The conquest-based ideology and the continuity of deceptions and treachery remain intact. Even today, inexplicably, when technology provides more tools to accurately investigate our past and present environments than at any other time in history. How long will these deceits, along with the Columbus myth, continue? So that's really the point of writing this book, to discover what that new history is and to ask the question, why have we been lied to and what's being covered up?
Amazing. Just fascinating. So I don't tell me if you felt from the very beginning that there was a cover-up, or was it that you began researching 25-plus years ago, and all of a sudden you were thinking, why do we not know about this? Why? Wait a minute, I found this. I mean, you've written for Ancient America magazine, and that magazine is packed full of references and Wayne May's work and his discoveries. So was that the case for the book that you began researching and all of a sudden you thought to yourself, this is just insane? Or was it just a sense in the very beginning, did the research come and you just said, this is just much?
Well, I was very fortunate. My mentor, who I already mentioned, Bill McGlone, and his colleague, Philip M. Leonard, who have written many books, including Ancient American Inscriptions, Karl Marx, or History. After I had read the Barry Fell book and had relocated to Colorado, I went down to work with Bill McGlone. And Bill had been researching this for decades prior to that, and he was a retired engineer, a very scientific-oriented person, and had previously been an associate of Barry Fell's. But, you know, Bill and Barry kind of got into it, and they parted ways over Fell's, you know, lack of scholarship in some cases. And Bill and Phil Leonard went on to look at the Celtic sites in Colorado and Oklahoma that provide the best evidence. So in my years with Bill, I had access to his decades of work, including the debates that he had with the archaeological establishment. And I became very familiar with the tactics of archaeologists trying to debunk diffusionist thinkers like Bill McGlone, who claimed that Old World peoples did make it to the Americas. So I'd have to say, Cliff, that after reading Barry Fell and after working closely with Bill McGlone and Philip Leonard, it becomes very evident that there is a tremendous bias against diffusionism by the archaeologist and mainstream anthropologist of the day. And almost every case where there is evidence presented of Old World travelers, it is rigorously fought by the archaeologist and attempted to debunk these cases. And, you know, to be fair, there have been many frauds, and there have been many cases of misinterpretation. So it's not that a critical eye by the archaeological community isn't important, but when that critical eye actually eliminates the evidence from the record, that's when the disturbing trend that we've seen regarding Old World travels in America occurs. And, you know, in point of fact, when I tell most people about, you know, my research and what I'm doing, they go, "What? I've never heard of that." Well, this stuff has been around for a while. There have been many attempts, and there's, as my book points out, it's not just, you know, McGlone and Leonard and Barry Fell, and but there's hundreds of researchers, academics, anthropologists, archaeologists, cultural diffusionists, you know, that have been talking about this and presenting evidence for years, including Gunnar Thompson, who wrote American Discovery I believe it was in the 1990s, a great book that documents a lot of this with a focus on Asian travelers to America. So, you know, going into this and writing this book, I had to make sure that everything was very well documented, because no doubt the instances of smoking gun proof that the Celts were here and other explorers were here will have to undergo the scrutiny of the scientific establishment. And that's why, you know, I couldn't cut corners and put in things that really I couldn't stand behind. And in that case, several chapters were dropped from the book.
Oh, interesting. It's been noted recently that institutions like the National Geographic and even the Smithsonian Institute have been found to be dealing underhandedly currently, and I've mentioned this a number of times, our audience may remember that Zahi Hawass had an association with the National Geographic that was illegal, and now the State Department is looking into the National Geographic funding Hawass and giving special privileges to National Geographic associates and researchers to dig and research on the Giza Pyramid, unbeknownst to the general public. Do you find in your research that this is these institutions are not up and up, and that we have they should be questioned as a researcher of ancient America?
Absolutely. You know, I spend some time in the book talking about the creation of the Smithsonian Institution and some of the earlier directors of it, including John Wesley Powell and Cyrus Thomas, and really go into some of the history of those early days of exploring the mounds throughout Michigan and southeast parts of America. The conclusion by the Thomas and Powell was that that all of the mounds and artifacts from the mounds can be accounted for by the ancestors of the Native Americans, and this in spite of the fact that they uncovered old world artifacts at the bottom of these mounds. And in mm-hmm. one very telling a passage that I cite in the book by Thomas in another work, he refers to these relics from Europe that they found, and he notes, but we can't deal with them here. And that's how it's left. So there is a tradition, and moving forward to today, all one has to do is go back over the last decades of the Smithsonian or National Geographic and look for articles that address this subject, whether from the point of view of cultural diffusion of corn, for example, where one mm-hmm. finds many examples in China and in India showing statues before Columbus with the corn plant. You know, they're holding the corn. So, mm-hmm. it's not like you just have to go to archaeoastronomy or you have to become an epigrapher, to read an inscription. I mean, some of these examples are so clear and out in the open that to ignore them is to be blind. So we mm-hmm. we do have the blinders on in these major institutions, and it has been an aspiration of mine in writing this book is to be able to present the evidence in such a compelling manner that it demands reexamination of the whole area of who discovered America and the different old world travelers that made it to America, and the proof that's left in stone in artifacts that have not been properly examined by the archaeological community.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. You brought up something that is a fascination to me and to a lot of our listeners, and that is the mounds that are found throughout eastern United States. Can you discuss the importance of these mounds? You reveal a number of fascinating discoveries. In fact, I actually published some photos from your book from the Wayne May collection, and a number of those figurines are astoundingly good, and they're not simplistic, and they come from people who were high artisans, high-level artisans. And there even seems to be an individual. There's one individual that I highlighted who's wearing quite a sophisticated helmet. Can you let our audience know the importance of these mounds and tell us a little bit about what you discovered?
Well, I as you noted, Cliff, I published I think 6 articles in the Ancient American magazine and. During that period, became familiar with Wayne May, his work, and then eventually got to know Wayne. And he was very gracious when I asked for an interview, and I flew to Wisconsin and met him. Mm-hmm. And he was very generous in sharing what he knew, his stories and photographs, as well as artifacts. The story of old world peoples and old world artifacts as it relates to mounds is just as controversial as every other aspect here. Candidly, although I cited many examples of what are claimed to be old world artifacts from America, and many of them originating in some of these mounds, including what's known as the Davenport stones from Davenport, Iowa. Like I say, candidly, I could not say these were old world. Part of it is that, I'm not, an expert that could be able to look at a stone tablet and say it is this or it is that. Barry Fell clearly said that the Davenport stones were a Celtic artifact. And this was pretty much the case with the most important artifacts that really come from the Midwest, including the most famous, which is the Back Creek Stone, which was actually uncovered by the Smithsonian Institute. And earlier on, it was dubbed to be Cherokee, but later researchers turned the stone 180 degrees, and a old world language expert declared that it was a Semitic language, and it was talking about a star for Judah. This is documented in the books. So at best, we have a small sampling of artifacts with potential old world origins that come from these mounds, but clearly most of the mounds, and I think artifacts and the examples that you cited, Cliff, of these effigies, relics, are not old world, but they're ancestors of Native Americans. However, what I did try to show is there's a tremendous amount of room additional research, and one of the most important areas is Poverty Point in Louisiana. And if you look at the Mississippi at the very north, we're near Michigan, where these vast copper resources are located. And at the bottom of the Mississippi, we have Poverty Point, which is a gigantic ancient site. And about half of it's gone, but it's a circular rune. And this, I make the claim, was the welcome center for travelers coming across the Atlantic. Had the choice of going to New England and following the trade winds, or they could find themselves in the Caribbean and into the Gulf of Mexico and then up the Mississippi. And this was the case for a lot of travelers. So Poverty Point, which is not known or believed by mainstream archaeologists to have anything to do with the old world, I think is very indicative and clear and very important site in documenting the ancient copper trade emanating from America, and as a beginning point for many of the travelers that came to America. And a great example would be these Celts who made it to Colorado and Kansas and in Oklahoma. One only has to look at a map, see that by going up the Mississippi into Poverty Point to get to the Arkansas River is very easy, and then from the Arkansas to the Purgatory, the Cimarron, and some of these other river tributaries that you have throughout Kansas, Colorado, and Oklahoma, where you find this Celtic writing. And in addition to the Mississippi, there are other river systems that provided ancients access to the West. So the Midwest is important, but I couldn't find the smoking gun like I did with the Celts. But that just says to me there's just room for other researchers, and there's to look at how these earlier old world cultures interacted with the ancestors to the Native Americans in the area of the mounds, the mound builders.
But the thing that I find is a possible smoking gun is that Michigan copper plate, which does have sophisticated drawings and etchings and writing on it that you feature in your book. Why hasn't that been more researched to a greater degree? I just found that the other day. It's a fascinating image.
Well, as I kind of write in my book, there's just so much controversy regarding the metal plates that have come out of Michigan. They're referred to as Michigan tablets. Some are stone, and some are metal. I look very carefully at the evidence, and I in one case of the copper plate, where a specific copper plate did undergo metallurgy, and metallurgical analysis, they were determined to be modern, not ancient. And that's not to say that some of those plates aren't real, but of the tens of thousands of artifacts that are part of the Michigan tablet collection, the Michigan relic collection, again, I couldn't find something that I could stand behind. There's a lot. Most of them seem to be fakes, in my opinion. Some of them may be real, but the records are so muddy that I couldn't stake a claim on it. So to answer your question, I guess I'd have to say if they had all this writing on it from old world languages, we'd be able to read it. And that doesn't seem to be the case. So unfortunately, or fortunately, as the case may be, many of these tablets and relics from Michigan have been deemed to be fake.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, that's probably what we don't read more about them, because the scientists that are looking at them are not willing to reveal them because they could be faked. So that's interesting. Carl, I want you to talk a little bit about something that I think most of us know about, and that is the legacy of the conquest of America and how the Spanish, I mean, we know that when the Spanish started coming into the Americas, they not only did they bring cruelty, but they brought disease, which literally wiped out a number of cultures. But you spend quite a bit of time on these atrocities and this conquest. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of why you've posted that or written about that in your book?
Well, the truth be known, I only dealt with it really peripherally. You know, the way I intended, I was going to have a chapter that described in great detail and historically speaking, that era. But because it really wasn't so much my expertise, I relied very heavily on Charles C. Mann's 1491 and Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel, to describe the conquest. And the reason I dropped the chapter is because, most of the conquest has been pretty well documented. But the point that I tried to make in the book is that the conquest is still with us, and that the real secret that they're trying to hide in presenting a distorted picture of history beginning that Columbus discovered America is that the slave trade, the exploitation of the planet Earth for resources, and the destruction of the environment, without any kind of consideration for the original inhabitants or for the ecology, is the legacy of the conquest that is still with us in our ideology and still with us, in our actions toward indigenous people and in our actions toward conquering the earth. And so this was really, the most important thread that I tried to bring into the modern era, that why should we care about our history? And the truth is, if we don't understand that we're looking at a lens that is incorrect and we're actually looking in our rearview mirror, trying to go forward, we'll never get there. And we will only continue to repeat the mistakes of conquering, of exploitation, and of the destruction of the land. So the legacy of the conquest of Pizarro, of Cortez, of Columbus, where there was just no consideration that had a civilized culture, and that they were there for the taking. This has been sanitized in the old history, and even most recently, in the last 10 years, the Catholic Church, a pope came out and really justified that this purging and cleansing was meant to be and was a good thing. So, the forces of the conquest, the ideological, religious, and most importantly, the economic institutions that were behind the conquest are still with us today.
Fascinating. Carl, we only have a few minutes left, and I want you to tell our audience why the importance of your book is something they need to look at, and what you would like to leave the reader, your intention for the reader in writing this wonderful book, Secrets of Ancient America.
Well, again, I want to thank you, Cliff, and thank the audience for listening to this interview. I guess I would say that I wrote this book to learn for myself the history of America, and once that I learned through working with mentors and fellow researchers and explorers that I just had to say something. I had to write something. I had to say, why have we been lied to? There's proof that the Celts were here. There's proof that the Indus Valley cultures were here. Why don't we know about this? And why do still people think and say that Columbus discovered America? And why do we celebrate Columbus Day? We're really, have institutionalized a figure, Columbus, and a holiday that celebrates the exploitation of the Native Americans, the destruction of the earth, and economic injustice. So for one reason that I wrote this book is that I had to do something with this information, with the hope that readers would come to see that what they know or think they know happened in America was a lie, and that the only way that we're going to be able to create a future without the kind of war and destruction and exploitation that have been continuous since the conquest of the Americas is to recognize that we've been lied to, that recognize that a new history of America demands that we go back and learn our true history and teach our history to our children, so that moving forward, we have clarity from not only who we are, but who we can become. So I urge readers that are interested in what happened to the Americas before Columbus to pick up the book, and for readers that want to know why have we been lied to and what's being covered up, that's a topic prominently featured in the book.
Fantastic. Now, the book will not be out for another week. I think the release is the 29th, 28th.
It comes right up. And the book is being published by Barron Company. My website is newhistoryofamerica.com. That's newhistoryofamerica.com. You can order the book through my website. It's also available on Amazon. And my website, newhistoryofamerica.com, provides a little more background on the book as well as the author.
Great. I'll definitely post that website. The book is Secrets of Ancient America, Archaeoastronomy and the Legacy of the Phoenicians, Celts, and Other Forgotten Explorers. My guest today, Carl Lauerberger, is an explorer and an investigator. Much great success to you, Carl. I appreciate you being on the show, and I would imagine that you're going to be highly desirable for interviews with a lot more people because you got some fantastic material in this book.
Well, thank you, Cliff, and again, thank you to the audience. Good journeys to you.
Great. So thanks again for listening in today. Don't forget to listen to us every Saturday. I will be posting more people. Remember Patrick Chouinard, World of the Giants, Lost Race of the Giants is coming up, and he's going to be on ancient astronauts, I think, in the coming year. So we'll be looking forward to hearing what he has to say. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.